Welcome to Better Leaders, the podcast, where we surface good leadership and smart management in media and beyond. Today, I'm talking to Upasana Gautam, product leader at CNN. My name is Anita Zilina, and I'm your host. Welcome to Better Leaders. Upasana, I'm very happy to have you here today for our podcast recording. And I'm happy because I want to talk about many things, but I want to talk primarily about three things. I want to talk about the reason why someone leaves the tech industry to go into the media industry. I'm not going to say weird move, but very uncommon move. I also want to talk about the incredible amount of time you invest in mentorship and leadership development of others. And also the third thing that makes me very excited and that I want to learn more about is your approach to leadership and personal resilience and personal growth. Does that sound like something we could do in the next 50 minutes?
Yes, you know me and the things I love, Anita. I'm so happy to be here and very excited to talk about all three of those with you.
Wonderful. And we might touch on one or two or five more topics as well.
Love it.
So let's maybe dive right in, Upasana. Some people might know you, obviously, from your work in product or in technology or at CNN. But I bet that many in our audience also know you because you're very vocal on social media, on LinkedIn, on panels you're speaking at. You're very vocal about leadership topics, topics of resilience, topics of personal growth. Was that always like that? Why did you start to be so transparent about these things?
Couple of reasons there. To answer your first question, no. This is actually a fairly new development for myself and the type of things that I share publicly and the content that I create publicly and the knowledge that I try to pay forward. And that's where it really comes from, is a kind of need and want to pay it forward. I wish I had the knowledge, of course, that I have now, and that was shared, you know, with me by my mentors and coaches and great bosses that I've had, you know, 10, 12, 15 years ago when I was struggling really, really hard, breaking into the tech industry. And of course, you know, there are a lot of issues we see now that are prevalent in the tech industry that were, of course, still there and a lot more aggressively, you know, persistent then. And most of what I do now is notes to myself, and things that I learn and that I share really come from this place of, this helped me and I hope it helps you too. And that's really it. There's no, it's that simple as far as like my motive goes, but it took me a long time to get to the point of feeling comfortable with my voice and being confident with my knowledge to be able to share it forward. And the reason, I know we're going to get into this in more detail, is the reason why I was able to build that confidence is because of so many amazing mentors I was very fortunate to have along my path. And it really is this constant mentality of, how can I pay it forward so that, you know, other women, especially of color in my position, don't have to make the same mistakes I do? Or how can they learn from the mistakes I made? Or how can they navigate these different types of paths while it still being their own unique path, but maybe being able to anticipate the types of challenges that might come forward. And so it's a combination of all those things, but at the core, it's really this desire to pay it forward.
So it's interesting because I feel like I always ask folks in that podcast the question, do you think you learned more about leadership from good or from bad leaders and bosses you had? What do you think? How is it in your case?
I would say very equal parts on both, but it started with the bad, the quote unquote, the bad. And sometimes I move away from the labels of good and bad and think about it more of like what is ineffective or effective. And for me, when I started working in the tech industry almost 15 years ago, I had a slew of bosses that were ineffective and quote unquote bad. That was when I started to like experience my first circumstantial like things like gaslighting. And the worst part of it all was that I was experiencing it from my bosses who were women. And that I didn't realize how that impacted me until several years later when I had my first boss who was a male and was what I would say, quote unquote, good slash effective, because he became an advocate for me, a sponsor for me, a mentor to me, even to this day. And I had a string of those types of bosses after I had a string of like the ineffective bad bosses. And at that time, you know, I was very early on in my career. You're just trying to get by and survive at that point. And you're saying yes to everything and you're trying to please everybody around you. And, you know, while trying to grow. And it didn't occur to me until just, you know, 5 years ago, whoa, so much happened in that decade. What have I learned from it? And what is the type of person I want to be? And how do I want to show up for myself and for others based off of that, you know, string of experiences?
And you know what what really resonates about what you say here is I was stunned how normal it feels if you never experienced a healthy work climate, really, truly effective bosses. I feel it's very hard to even kind of identify that. I feel there is like this sort of sometimes, you know, Stockholm syndrome of, oh, but, you know, that's just the way it is. And it really drives me a bit crazy, to be honest, when I talk to specifically younger women, folks of color who are like, oh, well, but that's just how, you know, how offices are. That's just how bosses are. You just have to kind of get through it. And so it's really, on one hand, amazing that you make this journey. But on the other hand, I still find it striking and so saddening that we still have to go through that kind of valley of tears to get to that level of resilience. Isn't it also kind of sad?
Absolutely. And it's like, why? I think about that so often. And I think there's a dialogue happening around that too right now, which is, you know, yes, we want to shield and protect the people coming up from, you know, the hardships that maybe we went through and the suffering maybe that we went through. And at the same time, it's interesting because you're like, that suffering made me who I am today. But at the same time, there is like a boundary and like a level to which things become toxic, where they're not normal. It is not healthy. And they create really toxic, you know, workplace cultures. And so I think it's sad to like normalize that. I think it's sad to say, oh, you absolutely have to go through these like horrifically toxic experiences to come out stronger. And no, that shouldn't have to be the byproduct, or to become strong, that shouldn't have to be a prerequisite, right? Or to be a great leader, that doesn't have to be a prerequisite. So I totally agree with you. I look back and I'm like, okay, really bad experiences, really amazing experiences. I'm going to pull, the bad ones taught me what I don't want to do and what I don't want to be. I know that. But it wasn't until I had the good that I realized there was bad before. So yeah. I think like that's part of being a good leader is highlighting those things too, right? Is like, this is not normal. This is not healthy. This is, you want to create a safe space for, you know, your peers and your reports and your teammates, you know, to be able to come to you and talk about whatever they want. And that's what you don't get with the bad leader, you know, and that is what you do get with the good leader. And I don't think that you have to go through bad in order to become good. That's like a conversation or dialogue I struggle with. And that also I want to like try to figure out how to dismantle.
Yeah. And it's also, I do think there are kind of diverging opinions in the field. If you'd ask 100 people, I do still think, and I wonder if it's also partly a generational issue of, oh, you know, I had to go through it, so everyone else has as well. It's very similar to that student loan debate, right? Where it's like, yes. Oh, you know, it's a rough time, but we all had to do it. So just to kind of grow up, you have to have it. And I'm like, yeah, I wonder if there's just like two kinds of people, the ones who are like, yeah, we all had to do it, so you have to have it rough as well. And the ones who are like, well, I had to do it, so I will invest my time in making sure that no one else has to experience the things I experienced.
100%. Yes. Agreed.
So aside from the fact that obviously I'd love to work in your team because I'm sure you're a very thoughtful and reflected boss, let's talk a little bit about how that thoughtfulness and reflection and effectiveness, you used the word effective a few times, how you approach leadership. How do you make sure that you're an effective boss? How do you make sure that you're a whatever, quote unquote, good boss?
I love that question because since I work in product and product management and in tech at CNN and media, it's such a interesting and ambiguous role, of course, because you have to be able to influence without authority. You are a boss of a product, but no one reports to you. And at this point in my career, I don't even have direct reports, but I have team members and a product and stakeholders who are directly dependent on my work and me being accountable to them. So I think that is an even more complex challenge of being a product manager where, you know, it's like you have a team, but none of those team members directly report to you. And so I always lean on my practices and learnings and teachings of mindfulness over the last decade. And I like to think of my style of leadership and work ethic in general as mindful leadership. And, you know, you could kind of maybe associate it with, you know, servant leadership, but mindful leadership at its core is really having the ability to consciously cultivate the ability to be present and open-minded and, of course, compassionate when you're interacting with your team members, and that you empower them to show the same care and consideration to themselves as well, that you know when to shut down, you know, a reactivity, busy mode and notice and respond to what's happening in the moment instead of defaulting to those reactive patterns. I think this is also very similar to what is coined as situational leadership. And I know mindfulness in general has, you know, it's become so commercialized and conflated, especially in America over the last couple of years, but maybe a little, you know, like fluffy, but it's quite the opposite. And I think that it really focuses on developing the skill set around mindfulness, which, you know, in the many years that I've spent teaching and learning and practicing, there are some really, really just like outsized advantages that I found it helps me with and that it's provided me and my team, which is a very high-performing team at CNN. And with mindful leadership, it's an approach to teamwork that I mentioned before cultivates this sense of safety and loyalty and trust and respect. The people around mindful leaders want to show up and do their best because they feel like they're cared for and they're appreciated and they're seen for their unique strengths and their efforts. They know that, you know, they're cared for and that their work creates impact and drives value. And it's the job of that product leader, you know, or leader or boss to motivate them to continually bring their best work because you're able to communicate those things like value and impact. So I think it's a combination of a lot of different skill sets. And I talk about mindful communication a lot, but that to me is like the core of all of it is like mindful communication and having really high agency is kind of like what I think of as the combination of mindful leadership.
So let's break that down, because I think that's going to be really interesting for a lot of folks listening who are like, oh my God, my workplace is definitely not, let's say, mindfully led. We're at the very early stages of being an organization that's like so respectful and so thoughtful and so resilient. How do we get there? What does it mean practically? Can you give me some like hands-on examples? What does it mean that you bring that mindset of mindfulness to the job and to your teams and to your collaborators? What does it mean for meetings? What does it mean for feedback conversations? What does it mean for difficult conversations when you have to tell someone this did not work out?
Excellent question. And I think your question in itself is almost the answer. I mentioned one of the skills that I think makes really effective, powerful leaders and product managers as well is high agency, which is, in a nutshell, you don't wait for others or for situations to be perfect for you to take action. You're able to assess and take action without waiting for conditions to be a certain way and for you to be comfortable. And that is, you know, I think a really, really important piece of this. And you mentioned in your question, like, what if they're in an organization where it's not mindfully led? I don't know of any media organization that is just from top to bottom, side to side, mindfully led. I don't even think that exists, but you have the agency to be that person. And I think one of the most important lessons I've learned about leadership is that you don't have to wait until you reach the top to become a leader. You can be in any position and you can act, think, speak, become a leader. It is a mindset. It's a practice. You don't have to wait till you attain a certain title. You have the power to do it right now. And it has a compounding effect, right? Like attracts like. You start to create more people like that. You start to help people think that way as well. And like, it's a shift in mentality that has to happen. And we can't just depend on, you know, leadership all the way at the top to do these things for us. It has to start at the bottom, like as individual contributors in like a very grassroots type of way. And so I think that is the most important like mentality to cultivate, is that don't wait. You don't need to wait for someone else to like to affect change. You don't have to wait till you reach the top to become a leader, that you have the power and the agency to make changes, even if they're small, in your team, in your organization, in different conversations that you have with people one-on-one. There's the opportunity is very abundant if you take it.
And I fundamentally totally agree with you on this. Whilst I still see that it's very hard for folks who are in organizations where the general, let's say the general philosophy and the general ethics of leadership is just not on par with what they personally perceive to be good and healthy and respectful and supportive leadership. So I think what we are seeing specifically these days with that kind of mindset shift happening in the industry, not just the media industry, but also the media industry, is we're seeing that quite a lot of folks who are brought in as, you know, the person, most likely the woman, the person of color, the change maker, who's brought in to basically change all the things that didn't work out culture-wise to be like the ethical leader, that they become frustrated after half a year, and leave again because the organization just was no hospitable place for them. And they were tasked with like changing something that has been built up over years, sometimes hundreds of years in old media organizations. Do you think that's just kind of a, one or two people, and I just happen to see that, you know, because I'm deep in that industry? Or do you feel that this is a trend or a risk that we are facing as an industry?
I think it's so much bigger than an industry problem. This is like pervasive across every industry. We live in, you know, especially in America, we live in a capitalist economy that's driven by, you know, revenue and shareholders, and everything else comes after that, right? And that is a really harsh reality that sometimes you kind of have to take into account when you go into these types of situations and conversations. With that being said, because it's such a pervasive, like, and just, you know, ubiquitous problem across industries, across the country, and, you know, other parts of the world too, that is why it can't be like one change maker coming into an organization and trying to change it, or into one industry. It's one of the reasons, like, I encourage, and I think this is just a kind of a thing across leadership too, is encouraging others to use their voice, right? Because the more we share, the more we learn, the more we can change. And I think that is like the core, that's like the first step of all of this, right? Is like, if we're having these conversations, you know, behind walls or, you know, behind a veil, they're not going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
And so most of them are, right? And I think it is, as a leader, you have to be effective and have that safe space so people can come and tell you. So if they're not telling you anything, that in itself is a huge problem, right? It's a blocker to even opening up the doors to creating change if your own people aren't coming to you. I would assess that, right? Like, is how much do my people trust me, and how much information and experiential knowledge that they have, are they willing to come and tell me? And I think that's kind of like the double-edged sword of leadership, right? Sometimes it's like you have to bear the burden of a lot of that type of information from your colleagues and your teammates and your reports. But especially in those like change maker types of positions, you know, I would assess, like, you know, there's so many leaders who say, my door is open, Slack me anytime. But that is that's very reactive. And like, you are telling people to do something and come to you, as opposed to putting yourself in front of people and voicing, you know, what your priorities are, what your vision is, and what your needs are. And so that's why I kind of always go back to saying it starts at that individual contributor level of like, if you don't need to be a director or a CEO to say, I'm here to facilitate a conversation, right? Like, you can be that trusted person and become a leader because of it. To me, that's where it starts, is like creating safe spaces to have those conversations and actually sticking by those words.
Yeah. And I think that's an excellent, not just start, but an excellent approach. And I also do feel part of the reason why I started Better Leaders Lab is also because I felt we need to have these conversations in public, right? I was starting to get to this point where I'm like, I'm a product person, I'm a strategy person, I worked in kind of digital change roles for many, many years. But I feel we don't talk enough about culture. We don't talk enough about values. We don't talk enough about leadership and what good and healthy organizations look like. So obviously we all know these stories, right? We know the stories of, oh my God, this person is a terrible boss and there is something really wrong in this organization. And oh my God, you know, this place, don't go there. It's not great. But it never quite surfaces. It never quite, also not in a productive way. I don't just mean kind of calling out the bad actors. I also just mean calling out the good actors, if you want, right? We don't really have those conversations in a public space.
And I think that, yes, you phrased that very well. That was definitely what I was getting at the root here, is like, it's this duality of we're not having the conversations in the public spaces, and there's a fear instilled in people for very valid reasons of not wanting to share, right? Mm-hmm. Like, especially in times like we are in now, where they're, you know, we're in the midst of chaos and layoffs, and we just, you know, are coming out of the peak of a global health pandemic. Like, people have shifted the way they live and work, and there's just fear everywhere, right? So it's like, how do you help people dissolve that fear while also, you know, earning respect and trust and letting them know that, you know, these are places to have the conversation. So it's a very, I don't know what the answer to that is, but I do know that talking about it more publicly, like you just said, is one of the most low effort, high impact ways to do it.
I do also feel that women and people of color and folks from less represented communities in journalism have kind of been pushed into that corner of, oh, you don't talk about that because you're going to damage your career. Yeah. I kind of feel that was like a conscious, maybe that's like a conspiracy theory that I'm putting up there. But I kind of feel that's like a conscious push, right? Of like, oh, don't talk about these things. You're going to basically risk that you're not going to kind of rise up in your career to a certain extent.
Yeah, you get, I think that is very true for like the tech industry at large too, for the media industry. I know I have friends who work in finance and healthcare. It's the same message that goes, especially towards women and especially towards women of color, that you don't want to get labeled as that difficult. Troublemaker, difficult, yes, aggressive, like, you know, and I think that is also why I try to lean on the ideas and practices of mindful leadership, because there are constructive ways to have those conversations, right? Productive ways to have those conversations. By the way, that doesn't mean you're not allowed to be frustrated and angry and pissed about the inequities that very blatantly exist right in front of us, because they do. It doesn't mean ignore, you know, the reality of that or the emotions you have towards it. But it's also like, okay, this is what it is. Now, what are we going to do about it? And I think that's also going back to what I mentioned before, this concept and mentality of having high agency along with that mindful practice is super important. And, you know, like you starting this podcast is an amazing example of that. Having the conversations in public and encouraging more unique, diverse voices to come and share their experiences and stories. There's never going to be enough of it. It's never going to be saturated. Like, we need more and more and more of those, right? And so, I mean, yeah, I think it starts like with those conversations, and then encouraging others to join in by building that trust and respect. Yeah,
totally. What is your personal like resilience strategy just for yourself, both yourself as a leader, but also yourself as a human being?
I think it has changed. I know it has changed drastically since I've started working in news, particularly. And I've had to reevaluate and reassess and do a lot of introspection on, you know, what it means to me and what it doesn't mean to me. And to me, resilience very much, I've started to like, I have a love-hate relationship with that word now, but I...
Tell me what to use instead if you have another preferred one.
I want to... We should absolutely talk about it because it's a word that especially I feel like is attached to women a lot. Mm. Being resilient is like, you know, the way to thrive and survive and move up the ladder. And that kind of goes back to the conversation we were having earlier around like, why does it have to be so sacrificing all the time? And like, why do you have to be resilient in the face of so much chaos and oppression or, you know, toxicity? And again, it is what it is sometimes, right? And like, that is how we got to where we are because of those experiences for many of us. Now, when I think of resilience and what it means to me is a peace of mind and going into conversations and going into work and clarity around what is the point of what I am doing and how is it going to impact me and how is it going to impact others. It is dismantling the patterns of reactivity in my mind. I think to sum it up, peace of mind, reducing reactivity. And there's a word that I actually always, it's my favorite word, and I use it to kind of define this entire state of being, which is called equanimity. And it is that you, and I learned it through practicing and teaching meditation for so long, which is you deeply are aware of the emotions you feel and the situations occurring around you, the conversations you're having, and you're unrattled by them. And then you can make conscious decisions with a clear mind to move forward in a productive way. Or sometimes you realize maybe you don't need to move. But it is this unrattling presence that you can, that is, you can cultivate.
So basically like a hyper self-awareness in a way.
Exactly. 100%. Exactly. And it comes from, I don't know, age, experience, practice over lots of years. It's, you know, you don't wake up one day, and it's a lifelong work in progress also. But when you are able to, and this is a great, this is a practical example of like resilience in real life, is let's say you're having a really difficult conversation with a coworker. And they are just not getting what you're saying, and you're, and you feel yourself getting frustrated. When we get frustrated or angry, our bodies like physically react, right? We sometimes, like sometimes my ears get hot. Sometimes my, you know, your heart starts to race a little bit. Some people get like, you know, sweaty palms, right? You start to notice those things and you say, okay, this is not a, like, this is not a time for me to react. I'm not going to react right now. You know, I say that to myself when, like, when I feel that happening, and it's like, okay, let me think about what you said and get back to you, or find a way to reply that is not leaning into that reactivity that you know is about to emerge. Even when you do it at that like level, you start to break those patterns that you've had and have we all have built up over years and years and years of the conditioning, right? And so I think it, like, again, it always starts at such a granular level like that. So to me, that is like resilience in real life.
Is it harder, easier, or just the same to kind of keep and grow that level of resilience in the news industry compared to the tech industry?
Oh, harder. It's so much harder.
What makes it harder? Let's talk a little bit about the tech news industry thing. I'm really curious about that.
Absolutely. Harder for undoubtedly. And I mentioned earlier too, you know, I had to reassess and reevaluate how I deal with stress and chaos and difficult situations when I started working in news, before working just in tech broadly. And this is not, you know, to any surprise to anyone who's probably listening, but, you know, chaos is constant. It is not going to go away. It is here to stay. So that understanding in and of itself of like, yes, we want to drive change and build better leaders and create safer workplaces. We can still do that, but there's always going to be chaos around us. Like it's just never going to end. And people, you know, there's always the phrase that change is constant, and the news, I have changed that. And I think it's chaos is constant. And, it, depending on where you work too, but specifically in news and in media, and we've seen it play out time again and again and again over the last 3 years, especially. So what are you going to do, right? Are you going to let it crush you over and over and over again? Or, you know, and this is another example of maybe of resilience in real life too, is, or do you say, this is what's happening right now. How do I want to show up? How do I want to affect change? Or maybe I don't need to do anything at all. And maybe I just don't need to respond, because that is also not going to help the conversation or help this move forward, whatever it is. And so I think that's why in news, it is so much harder. And just tacks on to your other question of why did I leave big tech to come work in news tech, is because I, at the core of my being, am a very curious and exploratory individual. I love learning about the world and its cultures and its people's perspectives in different parts of the world, languages, foods, every part of culture I'm obsessed with learning about. And I grew up watching CNN and listening to Anderson Cooper and Anthony Bourdain. And I came because also one thing that my boss's boss at the time, he's left now, said to me, is like, I'm not trying to just hire great product managers. I want to hire people who want to change the world. And I was like, that was the cheesiest, most amazing thing I needed to hear at that point in my career. And the outsized impact I know that I have on the world every day is something I'm never ever going to get anywhere else. And so that keeps me rooted in like the why of why am I here? And I think that's important to have when you work in a crazy industry like news is what is your personal mission and your own value proposition? And is it strong enough to anchor you? And if it's not, then there's some reevaluating that probably needs to be done for sure. But that's what keeps me, you know, here. And also having the conversations like this about how there are so many brilliant people who are hungrily passionate about making change and wanting to change the world that you don't feel like you need to do it alone. And working in tech, it was a little different, like in big tech was different because I didn't want to make apps for luxury purposes for people who had tons and tons of money. You know, was it fun and lucrative and, you know, comfortable? Absolutely. But I also got to a point in my career where I was like, there's got to be something else. I think I can have a bigger impact on the world somehow. So that's how I got here. And
and I do feel that impact thing. I think if you talk specifically to folks who haven't kind of started their careers in journalism, but kind of, you know, entered journalism or the media space later on, I often get that answer of like, there is something about doing something meaningful. There is something about that impact. There is something about changing democracy and society. And there is also something addictive, I'll say, to that kind of pace, to that constant 24/7, to that level of adrenaline. So I think it somehow, you know, makes you addicted. So my provocative question would be, is there a certain limit to how long you can work in a newsroom? I mean, this can you do that for like 10, 20, 30, 40 years, this kind of constant level, even with a high resilience level, is that something, are you going to eventually, whatever you do, burn out because you've just been, you know, burning the candle at both ends and it's just the way the industry is and the news cycle is?
That's an amazing question. I would be interested. I think my answer, since I'm not a journalist, might be a little bit different, but speaking from someone who works in the biggest newsroom in the world in product and technology, I will say my answer is yes, you can. And I hope I do, because I don't think of mine yes, news is 24/7, but I think that boundary of where and how you provide value needs to be hardened and set of like, I am here. And I always say this, like I hustle for 6 to 7 hours. I mean, especially working from home, 6 to 7 hours of hustling in a day is like 3 days in the office, you know, like it's very, very different. And so since I am a remote worker also, I think it's a little bit different, but you know, when I am hustling for work, I am hustling. When I am resting, I am resting. And like, I think that having that like deep awareness and focus of what you're doing minute by minute is what keeps, first of all, keeps you going, right? Like having that, being so attuned to what you're doing lets you reduce the amount of time you need to actually do it, right? Yeah. And so that helps me a lot. I mean, the last 3 years have flown by in the blink of an eye, but I vividly remember all of it. You know, it's not like it has gone by in a blur for me. I very regularly reflect on it and try to, you know, recall the insights from all of the experiences, but really, again, giving it, I can associate that back to, you know, having that awareness of the present moment and always kind of lean back on mindfulness too in that regard, is burning out is going to happen if your day-to-day is in a state of distress, right? And so if you have those boundaries in place of your day-to-day, of course that helps. And boundaries is a big, you know, fad word right now too. And it's different for everyone. What it's like for me versus what it's like for, you know, the journalist in the night shift in the newsroom versus, you know, the executive producer who has to produce the morning show. It's wildly different, but for me, I had to reestablish and reassess what those boundaries were, including the volume of news that I was consuming has drastically changed. And it is extreme privilege that I acknowledge that I used to be an avid consumer of news, and I had to really reimagine and redefine my relationship with that. When I go on Twitter, for example, I don't talk about news anymore. I don't engage with news anymore. I share and talk about this stuff. I talk about product and leadership and, you know, how can I share knowledge? And because I realized that for me, I only felt like I was adding to the noise. And I don't want to create noise. I want to create signal. And like the way to do that is by having these types of conversations that help us get through all of that chaos that we are constantly, you know, overwhelmed with.
Yeah. And I think that's such a such a grown up and reflected way to think about that, whatever you might call it, work-life balance or boundaries or gentle blur or whatever it is. What I've been thinking about a lot these past months is that it's quite unfortunate that a pandemic was the event that finally brought the world to reflect and move towards hybrid and remote work. Because I think what's happening is people think that the way they work the past 2.5 years is what remote should and will look like if it's done well. And I think it often isn't, right? Because what it meant is you're in an effing pandemic, the first one that I ever experienced, and I think most people in this world ever experienced. And that means you're in an extreme situation of distress, anger, fear, uncertainty, and you're stuck at home for a year and a half, and you're expected to just pretend nothing happened and work for 8 hours, do like 20 Zoom meetings a day, and then just kind of take a 20-minute break where you cook dinner and then have dinner and then go to bed and then do it again the next day. It's quite obvious that that is not a healthy way to do remote or hybrid work, right? And I feel like, are we reflecting on that? Are we at this point where people realize, well, this is not the normal remote work. That's not the future of work. That was a pandemic and an extreme case of how to react to it. Are we already reflecting on that? Should we be reflecting on that? What is the future of work and hybrid and remote work anyways?
So I started working remotely pre-pandemic, and I've been hybrid working for a few years before the pandemic as well. And you're right, it is not the same. It was not the same at all. It was survival mode. That's it. It was, we were forced into this circumstance, and we had to, within hours, overnight, adapt. And especially when you think of the role of caretakers, parents, you no longer are managing one role. You were managing multiple roles at the same time in the confinement of whatever space you're in, whether you're in a 400 square foot apartment in Manhattan or out in your woods and with your entire family, right? Like, we're all forced into the same confinements. I do think, of course, the good thing that came out of it is it helped a lot of us finally, like you said, reflect on what are the things that help us thrive and what are the things that absolutely do not. You know, even though that distress that that caretakers particularly were put in, right? With childcare and school, homeschooling, I can't even imagine. That at the same time, you know, they were after a year or two of the pandemic. And now once they were, you know, you get settled in and you figure out what works and what doesn't work. It was very experimental. And now it's like, okay, well, I kind of love the ability to go pick up my child from school at 3:30, right? Or I can go have breakfast with my whole family before I log on for work and I'm not in a rushed commute. Like, there are amazing advantages that we realized that came out of it while having to go through that distress. And I think the workplaces that are going to be the ones that thrive are the ones that fully embrace the duality of that, that understand that hybrid means or remote means truly in the sense of the future of work is just flexibility, right? That there are other priorities in life that are just as important, I think way more important than just work. Your family, your loved ones, your mental health, your physical health. Those things should always take precedent over, you know, your 9 to 5. And working remotely gives you the flexibility and the freedom to do that, while also, you know, the byproduct of that is you become more kick-ass at your job. So
totally,
it seems like a pretty great deal to me. And it is, I can never go back. I certainly cannot. And I'm really grateful for, you know, the kind of the before and after, I think, that I was able to see too, of like pre-pandemic remote work, post-pandemic remote work, and now
you can't unsee it.
Once
you saw it, you can't unsee it. And I actually find it quite intriguing that there is a lot of like conversation about like Gen Zs, and they all don't want to work anymore, and why don't they want to come to the office, and what's wrong with them? I find it amazing that there are young people out there who are like, well, you know what? I maybe just have other things as well. And maybe I just kind of want to spend time with my family, or I want to have a side gig that I do, side hustle that I have time for. I'm like, whoa, I wish I was like that at that age.
I could not agree more. We have so much to learn from them. I was a mess when I was, you know, at that point of my life, like just barely getting by and trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life while trying to
I'm sure you weren't.
I truly, truly was. But there, it's inspiring to see their shift, complete shift in the way they think about work. And I think that's also, you know, we have the insights that came out of the pandemic, but also this entirely new generation that went through it and came out of it, that, you know, again, we have so much to learn from them. And I think, like, again, you know, embracing change is a part of it's evolution, right? Like it is a new generation coming into the workplace. They have different insights and experiences. Yeah. They grew up very, very differently than we did. Just like how we said stuff about the generation above us and they said stuff about us, right? Like, we have a lot to learn from each other. And I think that is the best way to look at it. We don't have to agree on every single thing, which I don't, by the way, but there is a lot to extract. And like, at the core of it, I think one thing that they have pushed and helped, you know, like, at least I'm a much, much elder millennial, understand, is like,
it's called geriatric millennial, by the way.
Yes, I know. God, geriatric millennial. So painful. So painful. I'll take it. Whatever. is like the importance of your mental well-being over everything. And I'm here for that. I'm all in for that.
That actually leads wonderfully to my very last question that brings us back to the very beginning of that conversation and also builds nicely on what we just talked about. If you could go back in time to young Upasna, first job after college, you kind of taking your first steps on the job market, what would you tell yourself? What advice would you give yourself?
Oh my gosh. Everything I share every day and from
now, you can't just give yourself access to your Twitter and LinkedIn. That's not going to work. You have to pick something.
Go read this. I think it would mostly come down to trust yourself. And the more you trust yourself, the more you will find the people who trust you as well. And I recently shared this on LinkedIn, and it was a pivotal moment in my life. When this happened, and I was interviewing for my first big tech job. It was at a very big advertising agency. It opened up the doors for me to work on like a ton of Fortune 500 clients. And anyways, I was in the interview, in the last round of the interview. And it was a technical assessment that was 3 pages, and I had no idea it was coming. And at that point, I looked through it and I was like, I know about half of these answers. I'm definitely not getting the job at this point. I'm leaving half of it blank. And on the last page, I wrote, I answered what I could. And on the last page, I wrote at the bottom, I don't know the answers to these questions right now, but I promise you I can figure them out faster than anyone else. And I don't know. And I got the job the next day, literally the next day. And that boss, that mentor is one that changed my whole life. And I don't know what struck me in that moment to assert that confidence. And I think it's because I realized I had absolutely nothing to lose at that point.
Yeah.
And I wish I had, that is what I would constantly reiterate and reinstill in my younger self over and over again.
What an amazing story to end our conversation with. Upasna, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Thank you, Anita. A pleasure as always.
This was today's episode of Better Leaders. If you enjoyed it, please do follow us and subscribe. Thanks for listening. Missing Link.